Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to a bonus episode of the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. My producer, as always, is Lou Pellegrino. Our guest is an old friend of the podcast. It is James Andrew Miller. And rather than a long discussion on ESPN, although we will certainly hit some ESPN topics, the top of this podcast talks about James Andrew Miller's podcast, which just drops today. A lot of fanfare for this. It's called Origins, Chapter 1. And it is a 5-episode podcast on Curb Your Enthusiasm, how that show started, how that show sort of got into popular culture. And it's really an amazing job that James Miller and the folks at Cadence 13 did, putting together all these interviews with Larry David, Cheryl Hines, J.B. Smoove, Ted Danson, Richard Lewis. And the podcast is released all at once, 5 episodes, so you can binge on it. And something that James Andrew Miller rightfully is very excited about. So a bonus podcast to help promote the release of Origins. And we will also get into some ESPN conversation. They have aggressively gone after Fox Sports this month. And we'll talk a little bit of ESPN's presentation of tennis as well. So James Andrew Miller, your bonus guest on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. We are tying this podcast to the release today of James Andrew Miller's new podcast, Origins, which he will explain in greater detail. It basically sort of takes you from, it's like it's a story on the start of something. And so the chapter one of Origins is a 5-episode origin on the show Curb Your Enthusiasm. All 5 episodes have dropped. We will probably talk a little bit about ESPN as well, but James Andrew Miller joins us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
First, before I get to Origins, can I just say the amount of publicity from this podcast company for your podcast is incredible. Well, I have talking points all over the place. I have producers pushing me to publicize you. I have not even come 1/100th. Of this kind of love and admiration for what I've done over the last couple of years. So you should feel great about the fact that Cadence 13 is truly a favorite son. It's like you're Tony Kornheiser and Mike Wilbon working for Eric Rydholm. What is it like to be, before I even start about the podcast, what is it like to have this kind of star at a company?
Oh, please. We're 10 seconds into it and I already feel guilty. No, listen, I mean, one of the reasons why I signed up with these guys is because they know how to do this. I'm new to the space, and, you know, my whole thing is I like to surround myself with experts and trust them. I'm responsible for doing what I do, and I try not to get in the grill of those who do other things. So, you know, I'm enormously grateful for the fact that they're, you know, trying to support this launch to the degree that they are.
What a diplomatic answer. The answer is, my God, Pellegrino and Corcoran, they love you a lot. All right, anyway, let's talk about, I am not a Curb Your Enthusiasm watcher. I have seen the show. I'm obviously aware of its impact on popular culture. So some of my questions for this are not going to be like...
Well, by the way, why you should be.
I watched it when it first started, and it got a little too much. It was not a pleasurable watching experience for me. I understand what it's genius, and I respect the people who love it, and those who love it are, like, obsessed with it the way those who love Game of Thrones are obsessed with it. So I get it. I'm not knocking the show. I'm just saying for me, at a certain point, it passed me. But I'm interested in that you had so many choices to choose from for your first origin subject, and I'm interested as to why Curb Your Enthusiasm as opposed to anything else.
Well, first of all, I mean, I do want to operate in between television and movies and music and, you know, probably some business stories, but even relationships. So there's a wide range of fields I want to cover. But the idea that, I mean, I happen to have written about television a lot. And so television is one of my favorite things to talk about. And I also figured that after a 6-year absence, the fact that Curve is coming back in October and we were launching in September, it just seemed like great timing in order to really kind of like dig deep into this phenomenon that's been around. You know, it started 17 years ago.
Wow.
And so it like goes away and it disappears and then it comes back. I mean, it's rare in television. In fact, I can't think of another example where a show has had such a circuitous journey and yet still kept its fan base.
That is interesting. Can you give listeners a sense of how one... Now, again, you've written best-selling books, so you have a lot of contacts. But the people that you've interviewed for this... Larry David, Cheryl Hines, J.B. Smoove, Ted Danson, Richard Lewis, etc. You know, I've worked in the world of trying to get people to do interviews, celebrities to do interviews for Sports Illustrated. You get them, but it takes a while. Logistics of it are not fun. But you were able to pull off where you got these people for an extended period of time to talk about the process of the show. How'd you go about doing that? And did you, and this is just my instinct, did you have to get Larry David first and once he signed on, everybody else followed?
Well, I had some other people first, but let's put it this way. If Larry hadn't cooperated, then I don't think I would have done it just because, you know, I think the value proposition of the podcast is that we're going to make sure that, you know, in this instance, the key person is available. I mean, there are chapters that I'm working on right now for the future that, you know, I have other people, but I'm still logistically, scheduling-wise, waiting for, you know, either a person or two people or whatever. And if I don't get them, then I'm going to have to go elsewhere because I really do want listeners to feel like, you know, that they're getting, if not the full story, then a big chunk of it. So I was thrilled when Larry said yes. I had interviewed him a couple times for the Saturday Night Live book, and I was very appreciative.
What, if anything, what was sort of the most surprising or compelling thing of these initial 5 episodes that you learned from these interviews?
Well, I think there's probably 2 headlines. One is it was really interesting to trace the pedigree of how the show started. And it's not your typical show, which is another reason why I thought it was worth exploring. There, you know, we're used to how sitcoms operate, and this is a very unusual one. So I was able to not only talk to Larry about the evolution of that, but also to the stars and directors like Larry Charles and Bob Whitey, who is an amazing documentarian and who directed the HBO special that Curb started from, and he also directed the Curb pilot. So I think there was a lot of interesting things that even I as a Curb fan didn't know. And the second thing was that it's interesting, Richard, because this is such a, it's not a capital B business or capital C commercial enterprise. This is the Curb congregation is really like a Curb family. These people are deeply attached to Larry. Some of them, like Larry Charles and Richard Lewis and Alan Zweibel, since the 70s. I mean, they knew Larry when he was living in a crummy apartment and thinking about going on welfare. And so one of the things that emerges from these episodes is this idea of these people who have, some of them have had success, some of them had had failures, some of them, you know, decided to do, like Chris Albrecht, for instance, the former head of CEO of HBO. I interviewed him, and it's amazing because he actually met Larry because he was running the improv in the 1970s. And they've had this relationship ever since. So I just thought there was a really strong, I don't know, I have to say the word emotional component to all of this. And listen, don't let Larry David fool you, because on the show he acts like somebody who's very detached and very distant, and yet what emerges in these episodes is he's an incredible friend, gives work to people when they need it, is very, very loyal, and people would walk through fire for him.
The show began in 1999, or I should say it was developed from a 1-hour special, Larry David, Curb Your Enthusiasm. And I think if when I just read this before, that HBO thought this was basically a one-off, like a one-off mockumentary. Why did the show eventually become a series? Either you discussed this or you know this, but what happened after that one-hour special came out that somebody decided that this could become something bigger than just a one-off?
Yeah, I think that's a really cool question. And quite frankly, it was, when I outlined the thing, it was one of the central questions for episode one, because it was, even the idea of a documentary about Larry, following Larry around, that had its own evolution. And then what Larry and others take us through is, that jump, particularly Chris Albrecht and even Larry's agent at the time, Gavin Pallone, they take us through that transition, that moment, and those moments when all of a sudden you started to see in this special, hey, wait a second, this could be a series. And, I point out, and I think it's kind of just interesting that, look, Seinfeld was one of the most successful television shows, not only in terms of quality, in terms of inventiveness, but over $3 billion in syndication fees. So Larry is a guy who, let's face it, never has to work again. And so the idea that if he was going to get back into a series, and people forget that he left Seinfeld because he was burnt out. And so for him to return to a series, you have to know that it was going to be something that was really, really special for him and important for him to do.
Did in the course of your actually one more thing before I ask about sort of the release, the binge style release, which I thought was interesting. In the course of your interviews, and like you said, this is kind of an interesting series in that it went away in 2011. I think I have that right. And now it's back in 2017. Like, if you are a fan of the show, what happens now? Like, will there be a season next year, or is it, in theory, could these guys just go away for a couple of years and then come back? It's like, you are right in that a series with this kind of renowned and this kind of loyal fan base, I don't know if I know a show that's ever walked away like for 6 years and then came back.
Yeah, I got into that a lot in episode five. I mean, look, here's the equation. This is a show that is all about, from the mind of Larry David. I mean, even though he has other people helping out. And so the show comes and goes as Larry pleases. It's not like a network show where there's an order for 22 episodes for next year, and if Larry doesn't deliver them, then they're going to fire him and bring somebody else on. First of all, nobody else could do it. Second of all, that's not HBO's way. And third of all, I don't think the cast and crew would show up without Larry. So, Susie Essman talks about the fact that when Larry called her after season 8 and told her it was done, she said she went through 6 or 7 months of mourning because she was so sad that it was going away. She was going to miss the character that she plays, Susie Green, and she was going to miss being on the set with everybody. So I think that right now people are so, it seems to me that the casting, producers are so glad to be back. They felt like they didn't miss a beat, and they'll talk about that a lot. And then, they're all crossing their fingers because they want to keep going. It was interesting. Ted Danson, it was so funny because he's very, very interesting. And when you get into these conversations, and you know this from your podcast and from your own reporting, but, sometimes when you're talking to somebody and they don't know the questions and you're really just kind of digging deep, some actors need a script in front of them. And where they need talking points, or they need their PR people to tell them what they should be emphasizing. And, like my conversation with Ted Danson, I mean, he's so freaking smart and so clever and so wickedly funny about Larry. And so you he got himself into this mindset where if Larry calls and says, I'm doing it again, I want you, he says, I'm coming. I'm not going to say no. I'll be there no matter what else I'm doing. And so it's very much the outlier. It was so interesting to kind of hear people talk about just how different this show is.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, Ted Danson himself would just be a fascinating podcast, just given the fact that the guy was the star of Cheers, arguably one of the most successful, best sitcoms of all time. Has had
and
multiple.
People forget about Becker and CSI.
Yeah, Becker, CSI, and career. I mean, he has had an unbelievable career, and he starred in some films in the 80s and 90s as the lead. I mean, that guy has had
an amazing
acting career.
He was terrific, and I don't want to spoil what he says in the episode, but he says a couple of things, well, in many of the episodes, that each one of them I kind of found somewhat startling, given what you just said and what I just said about his career. And I think in that way also, I tried to make the episodes such that even if you're not a fan of Curb the show, if you just like these people, or if you're interested in television and show production, or for that matter, on a larger plane, creativity and how ideas are formed. There's a lot in this podcast that isn't exactly tied to Curb.
All right, last one here. And again, the podcast is out today. It is called Origins. You can find it on Apple Podcasts and wherever you listen. And I believe, am I correct about this? The first Wednesday of every month, there will be a new chapter of Origins. Is that the plan right now?
Lord willing.
Okay. All right. So you can, you made this decision, you and your friends at Cadence 13, now that you are essentially the Pod Saves America of the group. I mean, you and those two as the stars of the ball here. So you made the decision to, release all these episodes at the same time. That's very much the Netflix style, which is kind of cool to me. But that's a little untraditional for podcasts. I actually think it won't be in the future. But what was your sort of thought behind that, as opposed to roll it out once a week or once every couple of days? You release them all at the same time. This would be interesting to talk to the guys at Cadence. Like, I don't know if that strategy means that there's a potential to have more listens or less listens. It does seem far more user-friendly, which I kind of like. But what was the thinking behind that? Because that's not very traditional, at least at the moment.
Well, listen, my hat's off to my boss, Chris Corcoran, at Cadence, because, look, this was not something that we had contemplated. And then about 3 weeks ago, I woke up in the middle of the night and said, I just want to do them all at once. I wanted people to be able to either binge or just to have it there in case they wanted it. And you know, he thought about it, and, you know, God bless him, because then he said, okay. And let me tell you, you know, I pulled an all-nighter last night, you know, the terrific producer, Chris Basil at Cadence, pulled an all-nighter. It hasn't been easy releasing all five at once, but I think it's going to be more user-friendly. And I, you know, look, the whole idea of Origins, which is, you know, one chapter a month, is different also. So, look, we may crash and burn, but at least we're going to go out, you know, having tried something different. The other part of it is that we're going to be releasing in the month of September all the individual interviews. So there'll be individual podcasts with Larry David and me and Susie Essman and Cheryl. So all 13 or 14 of them will be released during the month. So in a way, there's a duality to it, which is you get the episodes, which is everybody kind of talking about things in the episodes, and then you'll get the one-on-ones. We call them Origins Originals. You'll get those during the month.
Yeah, I like that. All right, well, we wish you the best of luck. The podcast is out today. Check out Origins. It will be highly ranked on the Apple Podcast Top 100 list, although that list has some significant issues in terms of what's legit or not. But regardless, we're happy for Jim Miller's success. Can we now move on to ESPN, or do I have to continue to promote this?
No. What's working? You've done the Lord's work. Thank you.
All right, jeez. All right. You wanted to talk about tennis because you, a couple nights ago, you watched the Del Potro Dominic Thiem match, as well as the Federer match, but you're not producing this podcast. So before we do that, I want to ask you about what's an interesting, this is very sort of inside baseball, but it'll cross over at a certain point. And that is, ESPN has made a strategic and public relations decision, Jim, and I think you know this, where they are now actively putting into the marketplace how their shows do against FS1 shows. This has been a distinct change in the last couple weeks where ESPN used to highlight their ratings, but now they are making it a point to highlight what their competitive advantage is on a lot of these events against FS1. This is clearly a response to them being ticked off by FS1 executives historically taking shots at them, and clearly some Fox Sports 1 and Fox Sports Radio personalities banging the drum about them being left-leaning and liberal-only political correctness organization. So this is really interesting to me because this was a major dramatic PR shift from Bristol. And obviously you don't make that PR shift unless the executives top have signed off. One, have you noticed this? And two, if you've noticed this, what's your sort of take on it?
Well, I have noticed it. I have to say, though, that because I don't follow, you know, all the press releases and see them as often as you do, I think your Twitter feed alerted me to just how dramatic a change it was. And I think you're correct. It is a change. And, I mean, just to give a quick minute of historical context to this, look, in the early days of ESPN, they were, as everybody likes to say, the little engine that could, and they were in their own little biosphere in Bristol, Connecticut, not comparing themselves to anyone, just trying to survive and trying to do things the way that they had to do because they didn't have a lot of money and they didn't have a lot of properties. And so they just went about their way. And then when they became kind of like the big monster, they kept to that because, once again, and I think a lot of this is really informed by the fact that they've been in Bristol, Connecticut. It would have been different if they had been headquartered in New York. But they had their own view of the world. They had their own place, and they weren't really comparing things to anybody else. I think the only time that it really crossed over was when little ESPN wound up getting big and eating, you know, Goliath ABC Sports. And there was a very, very difficult and traumatic and actually industry-changing, you know, probably 9 or 10 months when they just gobbled up the place. But aside from that, they really have been in their own world. I think that what's going on now is more than just a PR move, because you're exactly right. Nothing like this could be executed just from Chris LaPlaca, who runs communications at ESPN, and his shop. I mean, Chris is probably, he has the autonomy to do that, but I think knowing Chris and the way he gets involved with executives and how much he wants to have, you know, the approval and be in coordination with his bosses, I think this is very much an integrated effort. And I think one of the things that they're saying, well, I think they're saying two things. One is, first of all, don't let good news travel slow. We got some stuff, and, you know, maybe we haven't been banging our chest as much as we should be, but there are some things that are going very well for us. Stop telling us that, you know, we're in deep trouble. And the second is, I think that they finally did get to a kind of a weird psychological tipping point where they got tired of being beat up by people that, by the way, that they used to pay a lot of money to, who have gone over to FS1 and to now, you know, their favorite indoor sport is taking on ESPN. I mean, look, Colin and Skip, those guys are very competitive guys, and they're very, very happy where they are. And so they have every right to market themselves and their shows and brag about whatever they want to brag about. I just think that, you know, in years past, ESPN would have just, you know, shrugged their shoulders, or in background conversations with people like you and with me, they would have said, you know, those guys are out of control, or, you know, they're half of what they say is not true and all that stuff. And that would have been it. But look, it certainly makes things more interesting that they decided to engage on this level, only because I think that it shows the intensity of the marketplace right now. I don't, in a way, because you're in the trenches every day, and I don't envy you, because what's happening is, because both places now are, to use an old ESPN expression, flooding the zone with data and with their own spin on ratings and with their own, you know, thoughts on you know, who's on top and who's not, it almost requires you know, kind of like independent verification. Not that they're going to lie, but we all know, particularly with ratings, there are different ways to express things, and there's different, you know, context and perspective you can throw out there. And so, you know, part of, I would think, your job now sometimes, you can't do it all the time, but is to just look at a case study, you know, and say, okay, ESPN said this, FS1 said this, you know, where is the reality? And, you know, who's really closer to, you know, maybe the truth in terms of, not that they're lying about numbers, but truth in terms of, you know, what the perception should be.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. It's almost too much data on a daily basis to, not necessarily to process, but certainly to interpret. And it's a burnout job. I think there's a reason people cover media, at least historically, probably just, you know, wrote 3 days a week as opposed to seven, because at this point you could, you know, there's an item every day. Here's the one thing I would just say, that to use a wrestling analogy, people who follow pro wrestling would say that if you're the WWF, this is sort of going a little old school, you don't talk about WCW, which was the group that was trying to, the insurgent that was trying to take down Vince McMahon. But I look at it differently. I understand that, you know, the whole idea, you don't punch down. If you're the 20,000-pound gorilla, you don't mention the new shop down the street. I think ESPN, though, had to try to figure out something to change the narrative, because they were getting out narrative on a daily basis, specifically the idea of them being a liberal network that is political correctness run amok. And to me, the viewership story is a great narrative for them, because FS1 can't beat them on this. FS1 is going to get better ratings this year in college football because they have a better schedule. And, you know, they'll have a nice month in September, October, because the world's, they'll get some playoff games. But as a rule, and Jim, you know this, you're not beating ESPN in viewership if you're those guys. They just have too much inventory. So to me, I actually think it's a smart move, twofold. One, I think you can actually put a narrative out there that's positive, and ESPN's narrative the last 6 months has been terrible. And secondly, I think in-house, this is the one sort of place I want to go with you just real quick. In-house, I think it does tell your employees that, like, if you're the PR department in particular, like, we're not going to take shit anymore. We're going to throw it back in their face. And if nothing else, we're going to make you proud of us, that we're not just going to be a punching bag. So I sort of saw it in that it's a good move for the employees to see that the company as a whole is pushing back. Obviously, we all know that this stuff, the rating stuff, is done for media buyers and the ad community. It's not done for people on Twitter or even people like me. It's done so you can let potential advertisers know that you're the big dog on the block. But what do you think? What do you think of that, Jim? In terms of for the rank and file seeing this kind of stuff, who are working in Bristol, feeling better about hey, finally we're firing back at these guys.
Look, I think it is probably interesting for the employees. Although I have talked to some employees who have said, you know, why are we bothering with them? I mean, you know, it's ridiculous. We're giving them attention they don't deserve. But I'm sure that there are other employees who love it. But I want to push back a little bit on what you just said, because it's not just for the media buyers. You know, one of the things I think we've seen in the sports space, and particularly with ESPN, is a migration from the political world and political tactics, dating back to Lee Atwater in the 80s or whatever. Yeah. And this whole idea of, you know, campaigns online and strategically placing attitudes and opinions in places like the Wall Street Journal and other places where there's a narrative that has been brokered about ESPN over the past couple of years. And it's not just grains of sand. I mean, if you look at it, it's a beach. The people who compete with ESPN, and I think particularly, let's say FS1, the Fox company, the greater Fox company, I think have put together a pretty strategic, well thought out, and this is not like, you know, the right wing conspiracy kind of thing, but it is there is a narrative out there that has played itself out on different platforms with different voices about ESPN and about ESPN's alleged political leanings and about their business model and other things. And so I think that, you know, part of the pushing back is to seize the narrative back and to start deciding and letting people realize that some of what is being said may not be true, at least in ESPN's mind. So I think we're kind of strapped in for a very, very public debate now, not just about what ESPN offers. It used to be, you know, well, do you like this show or this show, or this guy is going to leave or whatever. We're talking about, you know, the DNA of what ESPN is today, and whether or not it has a political agenda, and whether or not it goes too far into this or that, or, you know, how they police their employees and what their culture is like. So I think it's, in many ways, it's really, it just reminds me of the political world. And for a long time, that was not part of the sports media equation.
I agree with everything you just said. I think it's really interesting, except one thing. I don't know if it's as coordinated on FS1's part as you might think. I think there are individuals, personalities, who are trying to use ESPN to get some run for themselves, which is certainly their right, but I think it's pretty obvious on
I
that.
Guess,
and then
know,
so, and then just hold on. And then secondly, and here's the reason why, and no doubt Jamie Horowitz and Charlie Dixon and some of the other FS1 executives have absolutely put this into the marketplace with some friendly media reporters. No doubt about that. But I think just because I deal with their public relations department, I don't think it's as coordinated PR-wise as you might think. They've had a lot of turnover at Fox Sports PR, and the old hands who would have been more like political operatives are gone. So I see it more as a narrative being pushed by some by disparate people at Fox Sports, which still leads to the same result. I'm just not sure it's as coordinated as tightly as you know,
well,
an Atwater or a Kellyanne Conway or a Paul Manafort.
Let me give you one, probably not on that level, but let me give you one example that fueled my use of the word coordinated. Jason Whitlock wrote a op-ed, and it didn't appear in the New York Times or the Washington Post. It appeared in the Murdoch-owned Wall Street Journal.
Great point.
Now, that's not to say that, you know, that there's a conspiracy. No. And, of course, Jason, as an employee, may want to write for, you know, the sister company. But the point is, though, that column got a lot of attention, and particularly because the patina of the Wall Street Journal. And, you know, I think that that was just another way to ramp up their messaging. Whether or not you agreed with the column, that, you know, that's beside the point. But I think that that was interesting, at least for me, that someone like Jason would write on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal and talk about a topic that is rarely mentioned in those spaces.
Yeah, and he's written for them multiple times now, and that's an excellent point. My God, I wish I could get paid by Fox and ESPN multiple times. I might have a bigger house. All right, let's finish up here. First of all, I didn't even know you watch tennis. I figured you'd be so busy with Origins promotion that you don't have time for anything else.
Well, but the match was on in the background. Let's be clear. I'll admit to that.
All right, so I'm watching, and this is going to be a couple of days old, but we'll talk about it anyway. As a general rule, we'll start with this. As a general rule, I really appreciate ESPN's tonnage when it comes to tennis. I think they broadcast the tournaments that they do at a very, very high quality, particularly giving you a lot of offerings. And online, it's fantastic. It is an unbelievable resource if you're watching the U.S. Open on Watch ESPN. Their announcers, all of this is subjective. I like some of them very much. Darren Cahill, in particular, I think is sensational. Chris Fowler's turned into a great, great tennis game caller. Obviously, a lot of people like John McEnroe. I really like Chris McKendry's work. I think Pam Shriver's actually underrated, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so there's good and bad there. There are some people who complain, I think rightly so, or criticize rightly so, that the coverage is too white. Need more people of color on the broadcast. I think that's fair, too. And then finally, I think they, a lot of times, are way too over the top in terms of rah-rahing for either Americans or certain narratives that they want. Now, this brings us to a couple nights ago, Jim, where both of us are watching the Federer match against Kohlschreiber and Del Potro playing Thiem. And what did you want to say about this?
Well, I just think it's one of those moments where, I mean, look, it's all about the truck, right? I mean, it's all about the production truck. And I think sometimes people who are really interested in, you know, television, sports, and get it. It was one of those nights where you really get to, like, think about what's going on in the truck, because there were some interesting and important decisions, and they have to be made on the spot. You have two matches going on at the same time, and Federer is obviously having a magical year, and he is, you know, a big favorite. People love to watch him. And yet, at the same time, you have this amazing match with, I guess, you know, maybe Chris Fowler said it, people have said it through the years. Del Potro is always everybody's second favorite tennis player. You know, either you're, right. You know, you're like a Federer guy, you're a Nadal guy, you know, you're like a Djokovic guy, and then you're second or woman, and your second favorite is Del Potro on the men's side. But so there was a myriad of choices that they had in the truck, and they could have just stayed with the favorite, with Federer, and then they could have put on, you know, they could have cut to it during commercials, commercial breaks, or inside of breaks in that match. They could have gone full screen to Del Potro and given people updates, which is what they did at some point. And they could have had the split screen also. I mean, it was interesting to me that they had the split screen on when Federer was actually serving for the set. So that to me was a signal that the truck had decided that this Del Potro match, which was, you know, in some ways, I mean, historic in terms of the comeback that he engineered. They sent us a message that this is an amazing match. I think it was 3-3 in the fifth when Federer was serving for the first set. So it wasn't even a pivotal game. I mean, every game is pivotal in the fifth set, but it wasn't a pivotal moment, and they still had the split screen. And, you know, look, we could argue, and I saw on Twitter that some people couldn't believe that they had let, that they were squeezing the Del Potro match to fit in Federer. Some people only wanted to see Federer on a full screen. I think that, you know, it was just one of those moments there where you realize producers matter, the truck matters, there are lots of decisions to be made. You know, these things happen, you know, in live sporting events all the time, but this was not your usual choice in terms of, I mean, when you're doing a football game, you're doing a football game, or, you know, an event. But this was actually two events at the same time. And I just thought it was an interesting window into, you know, what can go on in the truck, and, you know, people can think for themselves. I mean, I encouraged a couple of people who reached out to me saying, look, what would you have done if you were, you know, in the truck and you had to make the decision, and why?
Totally fascinating stuff. So a couple things here. One, it really does reinforce, and those moments when those two matches were going on reinforce just how important executive producers are, directors. These are the unsung heroes of the sports media business. They're not known compared to the on-air talents. They're not paid, generally speaking, unless you're really the highest of executive producers, anywhere close to talent. And their skill level, as a general rule, especially when you're at the top levels, is just really extraordinary. All that's, and I've always tried, at least when I'm writing, to write about producers and behind-the-scenes people. I actually find them far more interesting than on-air talents, to be blunt. On-air talents, though, are going to get you more traffic and more interest. That's just the reality. The thing, though, Jim, where I sort of, I'm not sure if I'm disagreeing or agreeing with you here, but I'll just sort of bring it out. When the Del Potro team match was nearing its end in the fifth, they had a split screen on for a while between the Federer match and the Del Potro match, particularly in that last game of the Del Potro match. And I thought that was a really bad call. And I think most of the people on my timeline, I have a lot of people on my timeline who cover and follow and watch tennis because it's one of my beats, albeit smaller at SI, but I'm still part of that tennis team. I think when you have a match of that importance, and we're talking about the second week of the Open already, Delpo is one of the big figures in tennis. You have to go full screen on that. The Federer match is still very early, even though it's Roger Federer, and he's greatest player of all time. He's, you know, probably the biggest draw that they have. I thought that was a mistake, and I don't often call out producers like for mistakes, but I did point that out on my Twitter feed that so many people who were watching tennis just felt that that was the wrong call. And I think that was an example, in my opinion, of being too beholden to Federer or Serena or Venus, where you got to sort of show everything. There are times where you have to go away from the American or the star player if the moment is hanging in the balance. And that Del Potro match, the drama was at its highest. And as a viewer, it was very hard to get all that drama with a split screen. You want the full screen there. You don't want a half screen there with, you know, announcers sort of calling both matches.
Yeah, I think that one of the things they're probably concerned about also is, look, people are flipping around.
Right.
And if they come upon U.S. Open tennis and they don't see Federer, even though he's playing, then they may not think he's playing that night. And, you know, there's a whole portion of the tennis fan community that, you know, generally just watches majors. And beyond that, there's probably another subsection that just watches majors when, you know, Serena, Venus, and the big three on the men's side are playing. So you run the risk of somebody surfing, going to U.S. Open, they see it's a tight match, but, you know, they're not really invested in either of those guys. They don't think that Federer is playing, and so they keep on going.
Hmm.
And I think that they probably, that plus the fact that they do have a loyalty. But, you know, there are other ways. I mean, they could have gone full screen with Delpo and put a little banner on there, maybe. I hate Monday morning quarterbacking to that level. But I just think, you know, the only reason why it intrigued me was it was a night full of, you know, truck decisions, and those are fun to see how they play out.
Absolutely. By the way, your guy Burke Magnus and all the high-ranking ESPNers love you. when I put that out there, fired back at me, basically saying, "Hey, I disagree with you here. I watched the whole match, and so I like when the top guys won, like Burke." Are on Twitter. I like Burke. I think he speaks his mind, which I always appreciate. And he's firing
Burke
back.
Burke is an amazing executive.
Yeah, there you go. Of course. We always have to get you to the point where you can make sure that your next book, these guys are going to talk to you.
I'm not instrumentalist. He happens to be a great executive.
Yeah, Corcoran's a great executive. Burke Magnus a great executive. Skipper's a great executive. It's unbelievable. This is why you have bestsellers. You just basically.
Oh my God.
So my point is that I like to see the top ESPN guys firing back, interested in their product. In this case, Burke is wrong.
Well, I would,
but I like the fact that
Richard,
he was there
because I don't think he's responding to everybody who's calling them out on Twitter.
Nah, he's probably responding to everybody. It's not just me. All right, is there anything else we need to talk about? Is there any other media issue? Because I think I'm done. The next time you're on, we'll maybe go more in-depth on Simmons and the Ringer and where all that stands now, but that's too long a conversation to have.
Just one quick question. Do you tweet during meals?
Do I tweet? No, I mean, I have two little kids, so I'm tweeting during this podcast, for sure.
No, but do you have like a policy with your wife and like, do you like put Twitter away?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, I have two little kids that I have to take care of. Yeah, I'm not tweeting all the time. It seems like it, but it's really not the case.
Okay.
All right. I mean, you know, I'm generally speaking, you know, between like 5:30 and 7:30, or maybe like 5:45 and 7:30. Yeah, you're not going to see a lot of tweets from me depending on what time those guys go to sleep or to 8 o'clock, but yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I'm just looking. Yeah, 166,000 tweets.
Yeah, but dude, that's responding to people. So I respond to a lot of people because I feel like it's a social interaction.
Hey, I'm not saying it's bad. I think it's actually impressive. I would probably shoot myself in the face having gone through that.
You're not saying it's impressive. You're taking a shot, which is legit.
No,
but I'm saying, like, you're a guy who's more of a CAA Sardis kind of steak guy. You're not going to apply to all the rank and file who ask you questions. Unlike me, I'm more of a union guy, blue collar. I'm out there. I'm out there talking to the folks. That's why it's 166.
Oh my God!
All right, listen.
Hilarious.
Let's get more promotion for you. Origins Chapter 1 has debuted today. 5-episode Origins on Curb Your Enthusiasm. You can binge on all 5 episodes. They are so I can get this on Apple Podcasts. Where else can I get it? Do you know if it's on Stitcher right now and some and Google Play?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Everywhere where podcasts are served.
So basically, the way to do this would be to go to Apple Podcasts and search Origins, or to go to Jim Miller's, Twitter or Facebook feed, which it should be all over as well. I guess those would be the main places to get it, right? Well, basically, let's face it, Apple Podcasts is the way you have to go. I mean, that's going to be where the biggest promotion comes. Yes?
Yes, okay. I think so.
All right.
But thank you again for mentioning it.
You're what? Yeah, dear Lord, I mentioned it a lot. Almost 166,000 times. All right, Jim Miller. He's also the author of a couple books on ESPN, Saturday Night Live, The Senate. What am I missing? CAA.
Yeah.
And CAA. All right, great. Listen, this has been a bonus podcast, and when you come on, it's usually very big downloads for me. So I appreciate your time as well.
No, thank you very much, Richard.
All right, Jim Miller. We're going to Jim's going to be on the phone so he can even listen to my out here. My thanks to Lou Pellegrino, of course, producing this bonus podcast, extra work for Lou Pellegrino. Thanks to all the executives at Cadence 13 who have clearly, you know, put out the red carpet for Jim Miller and put out the black carpet for Richard Deitch. And thank you, of course, to Sports Illustrated and everybody else who supports this fine podcast this week as well. Coming out after the James Andrew Miller podcast will be Kenny Mayne and Ed Cunningham.
Oh, terrific.
So, yeah, Kenny Mayne and Ed Cunningham should be a good podcast.
The best upfront performer of
all time.
Time.
Yeah, we agree with that. All right, James Andrew Miller, thank you very much for joining us on the Sports
thank
Illustrated
you, Richard, and thank you, Lou.
Media Podcast. And we will see you again the next time we do a bonus episode. Take care, everybody.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.